I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is out today. It's Here and Now. Well, for the first time since the end of major hostilities in Iraq, British forces have come under attack in the southern part of the country. Two separate attacks were carried out near the town of Amara, resulting in the deaths of six British soldiers. Eight others were injured. Now, meanwhile, American and British administrators in Iraq will begin recruiting Iraqi men to become soldiers in a new national army. The recruiting effort may begin as early as next week. The old 400,000-strong army was disbanded in late May, infuriating then many of those soldiers who found themselves out of work and impoverished overnight. Scott Peterson is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad, and he spoke to me earlier about the announcement yesterday that U.S. officials will begin to now pay former Iraqi troops a monthly stipend.
The American-led rulers of Iraq at the moment had not decided on what their final plan was going to be for the military. They did make a decision to disband the military, but what they hadn't done was clarified exactly how the payment structure was going to work. At the start, they vowed that that the disbanded soldiers would receive just a one-time payoff. It seems clear, certainly to people here, that part of that was because of the strength of the demonstrations against that kind of payment scheme, and basically, I think, also a realization among the provisional authority here that they had created an unemployed and armed force of 400,000 people that they probably wouldn't want to deal with at the moment.
Now, will all 400,000 of these soldiers now receive what will be monthly payments?
Well, the plan is to provide for up to as many as 250,000. Most of these were career military people. Those who were conscripts are meant to receive a single payment and be released of their obligations. Of course, before in the armies under Saddam Hussein, it was required that every Iraqi male take part in military service. And then, of course, there also is the possibility for some of these officers and soldiers to join the new force that was announced yesterday that is meant to reach as many as 40,000 strong within 2 years.
Okay, well, if the new Iraqi army, as it's being called, reaches 40,000 in the next 2 years, and we're talking about 250,000 soldiers receiving monthly payments now, sounds like there's 210,000 people there who in 2 years or so will they still be receiving monthly payments?
Well, that's a good question, and it's certainly one that that the provisional authority is going to put into the lap of the new Iraqi government whenever that is formed. They have basically said that they will continue those payments up until an Iraqi authority is able to make the decision about, you know, what to do about those people. And I expect by that point, especially because many of them will have found other work or other ways, means to support themselves, this would have been a gap-filling measure that certainly eases their security concerns.
Now, Scott, this new Iraqi army, how well armed will it be? How lethal will it be?
Well, at the moment, it's not meant to be particularly lethal at all. In fact, it's meant to be a border protection force. It's meant to protect particular facilities and things like that. And ultimately, part of the plan will be to make sure that it can carry out some of the duties that American forces at the moment are conducting in Iraq. So that would, in theory at least, mean that some of those American troops might be able to go home. But there's a long way to go before that decision is made, and they're talking about training that will be carried out by probably a U.S. contracting agency.
Scott, let's shift our focus just in the brief time we have left. Speaking of American troops, what is it, 120 degrees or so there today? What is your sense of the morale of U.S. troops, what you've been able to observe from your post there in Baghdad?
Well, I think that a lot of them are tired of being here, that's for sure. And I think part of that is psychological. I mean, never mind the heat, never mind the difficult circumstances, but I think a lot of them who have been engaged in, at least in the Middle East for the last several months and were for many months even prior to the war, they feel like it's really time to head home. And but they're also aware that that more troops are arriving, that there are serious security problems. And, of course, they can't be too happy either that there have been such a spate of attacks against them that have yielded, in terms of hostile fire, 19 dead Americans since the 1st of May, which, of course, was the day that President Bush declared that major combat operations were over.
Scott Peterson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He joined us on the line from Baghdad. The Syrian government remains silent about an American military operation on its border last week. An elite American unit called Task Force 20, charged with hunting down Saddam Hussein and other members of the top Iraqi leadership, struck a convoy of vehicles as it crossed the border into Syria. Syrian border guards apparently became involved in the fighting, and at least five of them were wounded. Joining us on the line now from Washington to try to get a better handle on all this is Anthony Cordesman, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome, Mr. Cordesman.
Good morning.
Well, Mr. Cordesman, five Syrian soldiers wounded, fired upon by another country, the U.S., possibly even inside Syrian territory, but no public outrage from Syria. Why?
I think it's fairly clear that Syria came into a real crisis with the United States in April over the fact that it might be harboring members of Saddam Hussein's government, and certainly over the fact that it allowed large numbers of volunteers to go from Syria into Iraq, which were part of the irregular forces attacking U.S. troops, and that it had given Iraq military equipment before the war. There was basically a set of tacit threats of, if not the use of force, major economic penalties. And while Colin Powell sort of put a good face on this on May 3rd when he visited Syria, the fact is that Syria is still very intimidated by the U.S. threats and pressure.
Will that please the Bush administration?
Well, it is certainly convenient for the time being. Whether it pleases the Bush administration or not, I think is harder to tell, because one of the questions is what will Syria do over the next few months and years, and is Syria going to be intimidated in terms of the Arab-Israeli peace process? Is it going to be intimidated in finding new ways to support perhaps extremist or terrorist groups to sort of get its own kind of revenge on the United States? This is a very long-term game we're playing, and Syria can afford to wait.
What is your sense? Is Syria giving safe harbor to top Baathist, former top people in Saddam's government, or is it hiding weapons of mass destruction, as it's been accused of by some in the administration?
Well, I'm not sure anyone in the administration has accused it of doing so. I think outsiders have said they suspect it is doing so. Frankly, at this point in time, there's no evidence that Syria is concealing such weapons, and it seems certainly not to have been concealing leaders, at least leaders with a high profile. Now, the fact is, however, that we really don't know exactly what goes on in Syria. It's a big country, and lots of it, frankly, are not particularly easy to cover with U.S. intelligence assets.
So just in the brief time we have left, this is a new American approach. There's much we don't know, but just in case something's happening in Syria that we don't like, we're intimidating them.
Well, certainly we are intimidating them, and the hot pursuit that occurred right on the Syrian border would not have occurred if we did not have both the goal of stopping any of the Iraqi leaders from getting into Syria and intimidating Syria. This kind of clash is extremely unusual, and it wouldn't have occurred unless there was high-level policy clearance to do it.
Anthony Cordesman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Well, on a hunt for suspected militants, the Israeli army rounded up more than 130 Palestinians in the West Bank today. The roundups may be further dimming prospects for a ceasefire involving Hamas and other militant groups, but then again, maybe not. Joining us on the line now from Tel Aviv is Charles Radin of the Boston Globe. And Charles, did these sweeps take you by surprise at all?
Well, a little bit, but not entirely, because it seems to me the Israelis and the Americans and to some degree the Europeans have put their chips on the strategy of isolating Hamas from the rest of the Palestinians and upping the pressure.
Yeah, but I guess the idea is if you get Hamas angry, they retaliate, and the violent cycle continues.
Well, it's a very tough calculation.
Yeah.
There's not more than 1,000 armed Hamas members. So their armed strength is not the thing to be afraid of. Their relationship to the masses of the Palestinian population is what matters. Right now, that population and the Israeli population, for that matter, are both pretty tired of this. Whether they're ready to go into a long-term final peace process, that's a separate question. But huge majorities on both sides would do anything for a substantial breather right now.
Yeah, a breather. But on the other hand, we've had breathers before, haven't we? Israel often says that Hamas uses these breathers just to rearm and, in fact, take a breather before the next series of attacks. Now, Charles, you spoke to Hamas leader Abdelaziz Al-Rantizi at his home where he's recuperating yesterday. What's his sense of all this?
Well, hold on. Let me come back to you on just what you just said. I think that's exactly the point of these raids overnight is There's a lot of subtext and a lot of behind the screens push me pull you going on about whether the Israelis are going to allow them to catch their breath, whether the PA is really down on Hamas or
Palestinian Authority.
Israelis.
Yeah,
the Palestinian Authority. Excuse me.
Yeah.
So it's not all what meets the eye, and this is what I would say about Rantizi as well. You know, he's still talking defiantly, but the fact is that he's hobbled. His son is in an adjoining room with brain damage from this failed assassination attempt on him last week. And even though the talk is still fiery, it's actually less fiery than it was when the summit ended and people started trying to implement the roadmap. Then Hamas really was fire-breathing.
So when the Egyptian foreign minister, Ahmed Maher, as he did today, says there is a feeling of optimism that something like a truce will be announced in the next few days, you think that's got something behind it?
I do. I do. How long it'll last is anybody's guess. Because, I mean, what people really have to know is that there's very little reason for Hamas to agree to a truce.
Right.
Part and parcel of the roadmap is first to take away their arms and second to frustrate their most central aspiration, which is to destroy the state of Israel. So you can't really see anything in this for Hamas unless they're feeling so much pressure that it's a question of survival or not survival, and in which case they may opt to survive through a truce today in hopes that the situation will improve for them.
Charles Radin, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Boston Globe reporter Charles Radin joined us from Tel Aviv. Just ahead, the poisoned wells of Bangladesh. Thousands of people are showing symptoms of arsenic exposure. And later in the show, want to be hired as a lobbyist? Well, your chances improve if your dad's a senator. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. In this country, we've heard a bit about arsenic in drinking water in the past few years. The Clinton administration tightened standards. The Bush administration considered relaxing them. And then, just last Friday, a federal appeals court upheld the Environmental Protection Agency's new stricter limits on allowable arsenic levels. The new standard is 10 parts per billion. But in Bangladesh, and parts of eastern India, arsenic levels are often much higher than that. And by some estimates, more than 300 million people in the region are at risk of chronic arsenic toxicity, with many thousands already showing symptoms of exposure to the odorless, tasteless, colorless poison. Richard Wilson is Malincroat Research Professor of Physics at Harvard University. He also has a long-standing interest in the poisoned wells of Bangladesh, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Professor.
Good afternoon.
Professor, I said poisoned wells, but we don't want to leave the implication that they were purposely poisoned. How did drinking wells come to be so toxic for hundreds of millions?
Well, the arsenic is a fairly common element, and it's been there for hundreds of million years. It's come down probably from the mountains by the rivers, the Ganges and the Brahmaputra.
The wells, though, are relatively new, right?
That's correct, because you used to take water out of the Ganges, but then we said, don't take that because it's polluted, because the Ganges is a sewer. So then they started drilling wells, and then they forgot to look for arsenic.
When you say, we said, don't take the water from the Ganges anymore, who's we?
Well, World Bank, UNICEF, all sorts of public health authorities.
Now, 1992 is when the British Geological Survey went in there to examine the water in the wells, yes?
Yes, right. They did some tests.
Why wasn't there a warning about the toxicity?
Well, they concluded the water was free of coliform bacteria and it was safe to drink, but they did not check for arsenic.
Now, how does that strike you? Is that a stunning thing that they missed? Why would they miss a thing like that?
Well, it hadn't been checked for most of this century. We started checking in this country about 1970. And I think it was a big mistake on BGS's part.
It was simply an oversight, even though their very purpose was to see how safe that water was in the drinking wells.
They hadn't understood that arsenic at low levels taken continuously can be dangerous.
Now, what does that mean for those people?
Well, I went to one village with 900 people in the village, and I could see 90 had visible signs of arsenic poisoning with skin discoloration, some had skin breaking up, and so on.
All ages?
All ages. But it's, of course, particularly sad for working people and farmers who walk around barefoot because then the foot breaks up, they get gangrene, have to cut the foot off, they can't work any longer.
How lethal is arsenic?
Well, the discoloration and the keratosis aren't in themselves lethal, but in a place like Bangladesh, they become lethal because of the gangrene. And in this country, they wouldn't be. However, it does in this country. We believe it causes cancer at those levels, and we know from measurements in Chile that at those levels, it probably causes as much lung cancer as cigarette smoking.
So what percentage of a population exposed to arsenic will eventually die of it, one way or another?
We suspect in Bangladesh about 1 million people will die of it.
1 million people?
Even if we stop the situation now.
Population of Bangladesh?
About 150 million, 120 million maybe.
How much anger is there at the British geologists who came in there? And is anything being done to get some recompense for people who were not warned by the British Geological Survey?
Well, the British Geological Survey is being sued by the Bangladesh people, by some of the Bangladesh people, and they're asking for recompense. Exactly what, I don't know. It's being fought by the British Geological Survey, and recently the British courts held that it was a legitimate suit, even though it was from out of the country.
Could be a landmark suit, I would think.
I believe it will be.
Now, you've been to Bangladesh 5 or 6 times. What's being done to protect people? What's being done to change this problem with the drinking wells?
Not as much as it should be, but it is moving. I, for example, have sent over money for about 200 new surface wells, free of arsenic and also free of coliform bacteria, which are now working and being done.
Surface wells?
Surface wells. And some people are going back to rainwater, collecting that in tanks, but you've got to be careful with that they don't. They've got to last 6 months before they're used again, so you've got to be careful of infection. Some people are going to very deep wells below a clay level at which there is no arsenic. But in each one of those costs a little bit of money, and that has just got to get done.
So the trick here is either to obtain water from a surface well or so deep down that the arsenic isn't there. Arsenic only collects at a certain point in the earth.
That's correct. But the real trick is to get money to the people who are trying to do this without it passing through all the sticky fingers, starting from Washington all the way down through the governments of Bangladesh, the ministries, and so on, and so that the money you provide to do this actually gets to the people who need the wells.
How optimistic are you that that will happen?
It's happening, I believe. I've got one or two contacts over there who are using it absolutely directly, a group called the Dhaka Community Hospital, which actually work with the people in the villages, and I take money directly to those people. I think it'll be about 10 years before we make a serious net in it. UNICEF is at last beginning to move, and they're probably getting about 5 or 10% of wells I think will be done within the next 3 or 4 years. But then it's got to be done throughout the country, and I hope that people in the country itself will learn what to do.
So in the end, is your concern, Professor Wilson, that because Bangladesh is not on the front pages all the time, because it's not a nation that even gets talked about all that much, because it's an extremely impoverished nation, that this problem could slide?
Yes, there is that concern. That's why we've got Harvard and MIT are very much concerned. It's a three-prong project. Harvard School of Public Health is trying to find out what we can do about diets, which will actually remediate the problem. MIT is trying to find out exactly why and how the arsenic is put into the water and what are the long-range solutions for good drinking water. Mm. And I'm trying to actually help in the middle of actually trying to get charitable donations to give to the people who are actually digging wells to improve the situation.
Do you feel there are many other organizations around the world becoming aware of this problem as well?
There are quite a number, yes.
Mm-hmm. Richard Wilson of Harvard, thank you so much for joining us on this important problem.
I'm delighted, and thank you for having me.
Richard Wilson is Malincroft Research Professor of Physics at Harvard University and someone with a long-standing interest in the poisoned wells of Bangladesh. For more information on this problem, visit our website at here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a talk with Winston Churchill's granddaughter. Her new book looks at the lessons everyone can learn from Britain's inspirational leader. And now that summer's here, Chef Kathy Gunst prepares a seasonal herb salad dressing. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a Qatari man held on criminal charges is now being labeled an enemy combatant. His attorney says he'll challenge the decision.
I think that the government's investigation was not complete. I think that they're relying on coerced and inaccurate confessions, and I believe that this would have been an enormous embarrassment had Mr. Omari proceeded to trial and been acquitted.
Also, a family affair in the nation's capital. Special interest groups are hiring the relatives of senators and congressmen to work as lobbyists and singing sea shanties at a tavern in New Hampshire. These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. Six British soldiers have died in southern Iraq today, and eight others were wounded in a separate incident. The incidents were the first significant attacks on the British since major combat was declared over on May 1st. The attacks occurred near the southern city of Basra. Greenpeace activists are rallying today at a looted nuclear site south of Baghdad. The environmental group is calling for the United States to clean up the site or let the international community do it. Greenpeace nuclear scientist Rianne Tula.
This facility has been looted, so a lot of stuff is taken out of the facility and is spread in this community. We've been here for a week and we have found at least 7 radioactive sources.
The Taweytha nuclear plant was trashed repeatedly by looters after it was left unguarded during the war. The activists say they've seen children playing around looted material from the plant. President Bush is hosting Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf at Camp David. The president thanked Musharraf for backing the U.S.-led war on terror, but also urged him to ease tensions with neighboring India.
The president knows that I will remain engaged. I have standby ready to help. But the truth of the matter is, for there to be a final agreement, it's going to require leadership from both the Pakistan government and the Indian government.
Meanwhile, when asked about the whereabouts of both Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, Bush said it's just a matter of time before the two are caught. As Palestinian leaders push for a ceasefire with militants, the Israeli army arrested more than 100 Palestinians in raids targeting Hamas in the West Bank today. Egyptian leaders say they expect a positive decision from Hamas in the ceasefire deal, expected to be announced in Cairo. Israel has expressed skepticism of any deal with the Palestinian group. The World Health Organization has lifted the travel warning on Beijing, China, because of the city's progress in stemming SARS. A WHO spokesman says precautions still need to be taken in order to prevent further outbreaks of severe acute respiratory syndrome. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 19 points at 90.92, the NASDAQ down 9 at 16.02, and the S&P 500 is unchanged at 981. You are listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. With a single declaration by President Bush, Qatari student Ali Salah Kala Al-Mari went from criminal defendant to enemy combatant. That means Al-Mari, who had been held since late 2001 and charged with lying to the FBI, can be held indefinitely, loses his right to legal representation, and if charges are pressed, he'll be tried by a military tribunal. While the Department of Justice says recently discovered secret evidence warrants the change of status for Al-Mari, others are questioning the decision. Among them, and joining us to discuss the case now, is Larry Lustberg, the attorney who has been representing Mr. Al-Mari. Welcome, Mr. Lustberg.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Al-Mari, who arrived in this country on September 10, 2001, is the first person charged criminally to be then switched to enemy combatant status. What do you make of it?
Well, my view is that it's absolutely outrageous. The course of the criminal case was a fairly ordinary one. A trial was scheduled for July 21st, and we were optimistic that we'd prevail. And the notion that the government has here interrupted the normal process of a criminal case, yanked Mr. Al-Mari from it, and put him in a position where he has little or no constitutional protection is, to me, really anathema to our system of justice.
Now, the Department of Justice says we're mixing apples and oranges here to complain about the criminal proceedings ending. They say the two have nothing to do with each other, the charges of being an enemy combatant and the criminal charges, and the enemy combatant charges overwhelm the other charges.
this case was on its face, did not involve charges of terrorism. That is, Mr. Omari was charged with bank fraud, credit card fraud, and lying to the FBI. However, it was always very clear that the investigation was one that involved terrorism. And indeed, the government had put us on notice that had Mr. Omari been convicted, they would have sought a very long prison term on the basis that he was involved in terrorism. So the notion that, the two matters are so separate is simply belied by the facts.
Well, why would the government do this if they didn't have good evidence? The government is not necessarily interested in hauling people before military tribunals just for the heck of it.
Well, I think that the government's investigation was not complete. I think that they're relying on coerced and inaccurate confessions of other people who are in custody, and I believe that that this would have been an enormous embarrassment had Mr. Omari proceeded to trial and been acquitted. And I think that what you're seeing is the full force of the government being brought to bear on an individual in an effort to make him answer questions that he otherwise did not want to answer, as is the right of others who are subjected to our system.
So what is your legal recourse now, if any? What can you do?
Well, the question of what we can do is one that's being battled out in the courts elsewhere right now, so we're going to be joining that debate. We intend within the next few days to file a petition for a writ of habeas corpus to seek his release on the ground that he's being unconstitutionally detained. We intend through that mechanism to challenge his being labeled an enemy combatant, and we intend to afford him every constitutional right which we believe he ought to receive given the stakes here.
Maybe this is a silly question to ask an attorney, but your client did arrive here on September 10th, 2001, and some of the new charges apparently stem from things Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, an important al-Qaeda operative who's now who was captured in Pakistan, who's now in prison, that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has turned over. Are you persuaded that your client is an absolutely innocent man?
There was absolutely no proof, and I don't believe the government has any proof, that he had any involvement in the events of September 11th, tragic as they were.
Larry Lustberg, thank you very much for joining us on Here and Now.
It's my pleasure.
Attorney Larry Lustberg represents Ali Salah Kala Omari. He joined us from his office in Newark, New Jersey. When it comes to political power broking in Washington, keeping it in the family appears to be more common than ever. Corporations and special interest groups are hiring the relatives of senators and congressmen as lobbyists in surprising numbers. The Los Angeles Times recently completed a series that found at least 17 senators and 11 members of the House have family members who lobby or work as consultants on government relations. That's 28 in Congress for whom the system is a family affair. Richard Cooper worked on the Times series, and he joins us now on the line. Richard, thanks for speaking with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. First off, is it perfectly legal to have a relative of a lawmaker lobbying in an area that may fall under his or her watch or influence?
Yes, it is. There are almost no rules in this area. The Senate has a general rule that says that a member should not do nothing that brings shame on the Senate. But the definition of what shames the Senate is determined on a case-by-case basis, and there have been no rulings in this area.
Now, the numbers on all this are more than in the past.
Yes, and I would have to say that our list is by no means definitive. There's no reporting, just as there's no rule against it, there's no reporting requirement that a senator disclose contacts with members of his family. So it's a very difficult and long process to pour through records and sort of winkle these things out. We've talked to ethics lawyers who deal with members of Congress who say that we weren't even close to having the total list, that it's become very common.
Uh-huh. Now, are there any particular industries or areas where this practice of hiring lawmakers' relatives is most prevalent?
It seems to be somewhat concentrated in fields and industries where the government policies and government decisions make a big difference. In telecommunications, for example, where the government really writes the competitive rules of the game, and in drugs and diet supplements, in public land transactions, mining, things like that.
Does it cross party lines, this?
Yes, it does. We found about equal numbers in both parties.
Who are these people? And we can't give the whole list, but can you give me an example or two?
Well, sure. Senator Orrin Hatch, who's a Republican from Utah, has been a very powerful figure in legislation affecting prescription drug companies. His son, Scott Hatch, has worked for several lobbying companies, firms in Washington that have paid tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars to those firms. This is the people who make things that, like Ephedra and that sort of thing, which Senator Hatch has had a big hand in writing the rules of the game.
Yeah, and it, as you say, it's not just the Republican Hatch, it's Democrats as well.
No. You could take Harry Reid, from a Democrat from Nevada, has protected the hard rock mining industry from reform efforts, and Harry Reid's sons and son-in-law have been involved deeply in lobbying and representing clients whose interests the senator.
Now, it's all legal, and we should point out that lawmakers contacted about this say that it simply doesn't affect their decision-making, that relatives are involved in companies they're making decisions about or areas they're making decisions about. But are watchdog groups concerned about this, trying to change it? Is there any way to change it?
Well, I mean, the Senate could certainly write, and it seems to be more prevalent in the Senate than in the House, probably because individual members of the Senate have much greater impact. You know, it's a much smaller body. They could change their rules. The people who have pushed for campaign reform could push for changes in these laws, as campaign reform, as you said, and other things have reduced the ability to ingratiate yourself with a member of Congress. This is a new and unusually personal way to send a thank you or a tip of a hat. There's just a web of relationships there.
Keeping it in the family in Washington. Thanks, Richard Cooper, very much for joining us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Cooper is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times based in Washington. You're listening to Here and Now. British researchers say dancing, ballroom dancing in particular, helps ward off senile dementia. Remembering all those steps and not stepping on your partner, it's a mental as well as physical challenge, as Here and Now's Lynn Menegon found out when she visited the Yankee Classic Ballroom Dance Sport Championships in Cambridge, Massachusetts this past weekend.
And let's keep your favorite couple on as they take their places for their 5th and 5th dance.
My name is Tommy Shaughnessy. I'm from Dublin in Ireland, and I am one of the co-organisers of the Yankee Classic. Going into a dancing competition at 10 o'clock in the morning and seeing these women dressed up with sequins and rhinestones and makeup all over the place, and, you know, you'd think a spaceship has landed in Boston when you see some of these people. But that's part of our industry. And we just, there is other parts of it that's also more in the moment, and there's part of it that's very much in the past. We call it now dance sport. The original name was ballroom dancing and Latin American dancing, because it is now recognised by the International Olympic Committee, because the dancers now are more athletic, they're more physical, more faster, more stronger, and the name is more suitable to the sport.
What do you look for in dancers when you judge, and what do you tell them when you coach?
You have to assess the dancer very quickly. We have 3 to 4 seconds. Many couples on the dance floor, we don't have a lot of time.
3 to 4 seconds? So it's a dog-eat-dog kind of world.
You better believe it.
My name is Chris Johnson. I'm the owner of the Super Shag Mega Dance Complex and Super Shag Productions in Boston.
I saw, I think, a disaster. Oh, another disaster. 2 couples just collided and 1 woman lost her shoe. What happens in these situations? What do you do as a dancer?
She tries to get her shoe on as quickly as possible, and hopefully the judges won't see it. The best ones are able to maneuver. It's a bit like driving in Boston. You know, if you're good, you don't crash. The not-so-good ones are going to be, they're going to end up in their backsides a few times.
Is there, oh, that sounds terrible. Is there ever any intentional crashing, collisions, like in a race car?
Oh, yes. This is a very serious sport. So it's like, you know, some of these people don't like each other.
I see that your cell phone even has sequins on it. Can you tell me your name?
Dawn Smart.
And you are part of the gown enterprise here.
I'm a designer with Dore Designs.
And can you ever do too much to a gown?
Yes, you can.
So feathers and sequins, and you put too much together and it's just plain bad.
It's horrible.
I'm writing my dissertation in dance history and theory on glamour and the American ballroom dance industry.
Tell me your name.
Juliet McMains.
Glamour in the American ballroom industry. Well, there's certainly a lot of it on display tonight. What's your theory about it?
I write about the way we produce and sell glamour in this industry. So I follow the political economy of glamour in the American dance court industry.
And what makes you do this?
Glamour. Promise of transformation. Knowing how it works does little to insulate one against its powers.
Our piece on ballroom dancing was produced by Lynn Menegon. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. On the second Saturday of each month, a group of people gather together in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, to sing sea shanties, songs from an era when young men sought their fortunes at sea and sometimes never came back. The songs run the risk of being lost over time, but the music is still alive in the hearts of many. There are few rules for these monthly sing-alongs. Anyone can join in. Everyone should feel free to bring a song to sing. But the songs must have something to do with the sea. New Hampshire Public Radio's Raquel Maria Dillon brings us these voices from a recent sing-along at Portsmouth's Press Room Bar.
Hi, I'm Tom Hall. Usually, I'll start up, I'm the host, I'll do the first song, then go to my left, the next person does, and just right around the room. I mean, there are no leaders in these sessions. We just share. That's what it's all about. In this case, sea music.
Rock a block, jock a block, heave a capstan round. Fish the flame and anchor up, for ye are outward bound.
A sea shanty is a song used to accompany work on a ship. Working the pumps, hauling up sail, heaving on a windlass or capstan. But these were songs with a set rhythm to get the work done in unison. A good song would lift their spirits as they lifted up the sails. The other one, the four-bitter, those are the songs sailors would sing in their off time for themselves, their own pleasure, their own entertainment. And they'd sing about the things they didn't have. Women, and drink, and women, and different kinds of drink, and good food, and women.
Sweet ladies of Plymouth, we bid you goodbye. Roll down. And by and by,
walk around me, great boys, and roll down,
and we will roll down.
Walk around me, great boys, and roll down.
And when we draw nigh to Australia's Bowstrand,
roll.
My name is Dave Hollowell. I live in Portsmouth. Going to Australia, it's a common theme, and it's one of those that's really the call and response, too, that's very powerful when you're singing it, to hear it coming back at you from everybody else. You can imagine what that's like on a ship, too, where there's one person kind of calling out the bass theme and then everybody else giving back the rest of it.
When those great southern whales on a quarter to spout,
And the thing about these sessions is everybody, the regulars who are coming know, everybody knows some of the songs, but more and more people learn. And the choruses are easy, because the shantyman who would lead these on a ship would try to pick things that everybody could pick up on really quickly. didn't have time to teach anybody a song. Here's the verse, here's the chorus, and off they'd go. And usually enough men would know the song, so it'd be easy for the new men to join in. We're here, we're singing for ourselves, and we find with this, it's actually not the people who come in for a drink or dinner. Sometimes find they're actually staying here for the music. A lot of people have just wandered in by mistake and found themselves staying and singing along.
Walk around me, great boys, and roll down.
Come, all you fisher lassies, come a while with me. From Cairnbulg and Cambry and from Inverallochy, from Bucky and from Aberdeen and other country in. What a whatty got the headin', a whatty Armathin. It's early in the morning.
My name's Tyler Buck, and I'm from Massachusetts, but I've lived in Scotland for a lot of my life. And that song was called Song of the Fish Gutters. They traveled all around the country gutting the herring, and it was a huge occupation. It was one of the few things that Scottish women could do other than go into service in a big house. This is one of the best places to sing in the area that I've found. The places in Boston have pretty much died out, so this is the best.
From Bucky and from Aberdeen and other country lives. When I want to find the gutting yards along the Yarmouth shore, there's Cooper's Ed and Jude.
The streetcar rolls right by her.
The sea music is such a blend of nationalities. Most of the body of it is English and American, but there were a tremendous number of African Americans on these ships who brought so much of their music on board. Then you had the occasional whaler from Portugal. You had the Dutch seamen, you had the Germans, the French, and all these cultures melded together to make a music that is not of just one culture, but of many. And that's part of the beauty of it.
My name is Kendall Morse, and I live in South Portland, Maine. And I'm a semi-professional folk singer, storyteller, humorist. I fix lawnmowers. Usually in a gathering of folk singers, you're going to get a wide variety. But in a shanty sing, we kind of try to stick close to the music of the sea. It's a bit narrow, but at the same time, there are hundreds of wonderful songs about the sea. So you could do this all night and never scratch the surface. The ones we sang at sea were not fit for mixed company. They were the real thing. And you got to remember that these sailors, the old sailors, were not choir boys. They were ignorant. They were misogynists. They were drunks. They were failures. And they didn't have a very big vocabulary. And their mind was always on two things. And none of those was work. 50 years ago in January, I went to sea for the first time. And my introduction to seagoing was a number 9 sea in the Davis Straits, which is between Labrador and Greenland. And we should have gotten submarine pay, really. And I woke up and I thought, what in hell have I done? What was I thinking? I had a similar feeling on my third honeymoon. This was written by Archie Fisher. When you're sailing out for the first time, men will tell you of trips that they've made, all the work and the sweat and the loneliness. And you feel just a little afraid.
Shantying began in the late 18th century and ended in the early 20th. And as engines came in, it ceased to be important. They have a machine to haul up the sails, raise the anchor. You didn't need men to do it. The tunes, the words, the poetry, just it's a body of music that is just beautiful in and of itself.
Have you ever actually been to sea?
Not far offshore, no. I grew up on the coast, but my family weren't seafaring people. My father used to get seasick on deep-sea fishing boats. But no, I've never been out far at all. Love to someday, but you never
know. He could not see the road. Chip chow, cherry chow, fa-la-riddle-diddle-dow. Chip chow, cherry chow, fa-la-riddle-day. Chip chow, cherry chow, fa-la-riddle-diddle-dow. Chip chow, cherry chow, fa-la-riddle-day.
Voices and Fiddles from the monthly Sea Shanty Sing-Along at the Pressroom Bar in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The story was produced by Raquel Maria Dillon of New Hampshire Public Radio. Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Cradell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna, and our editor is Mitch Wertlieb. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Allison Vents. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com. At mathworks.com.